So, good afternoon, everyone. Nice to see everyone again. And follow the same format as on previous occasions. I'll start off by giving a talk for 40-45 minutes, and then have a short break, and then meditation period, questions and answers. So I think I'd like to talk about time. It's a subject that's on many people's minds, and interesting topic, I think. Certainly one that plays a major part in many art forms and many stories and plays, and one short story I was very fond of when I was at school, I'll tell you about, and concerned a competition, the winners of which could go on time travel, could go anywhere they wanted to go, and you had to sign up and say that you wouldn't change anything. If you went to a particular event that you were familiar with, you had to fit in with everyone else. That was the main rule. And the winner of the competition decides they want to participate and see the crucifixion of Christ. So they have this sort of special super fast language course so that they can speak the language, and then they give them the clothes and then put them in the time machine. And the person who wins the competition, I think there's more than one of them, and they find themselves in Jerusalem, and up on the balcony there's Pontius Pilate, and he said, who shall I release, Barabbas or Jesus? And so they'd all read the Bible and they knew what they had to do, so they all say, Jesus, release Barabbas, release Barabbas. And then they follow Jesus, and and the crucifixion takes place. And but at the end of the story, turns out that all the people who are shouting and abusing Jesus and participating are all people who are on tours from the future. And actually, the people who are people who live at that time are all sort of crying their eyes out behind closed doors. And so this was one of the first. I'll tell you this story because one of the first things really sparked my own interest in time and time travel and things like that. But I'm not going to talk about time travel, obviously, except in the most peripheral way. What I want to talk about is our experience of time, because I think it's commonplace that the time that's measured by space traveled. For instance, clocks. We see a clock moving, so we're traveling. We measure time through movement, and clock time and the time that we experience is very rarely one and the same. So I think it's worthwhile looking at the causes and conditions, those things that affect our experience of time, and see what implications that has, or what ways we could use that knowledge usefully. One of the most impressive discoveries and technological developments, I think, in the past few years has been the traffic lights, which give you a countdown from how many down to zero. And it seems to me that it's been a great boon to mankind, as it's reduced an incredible amount of stress and tension at traffic lights simply by knowing how many seconds you have to wait. And very simple device, but based on understanding the way people's minds work, and that our sense of time is conditioned very clearly by desire. So when we want something and we haven't got it yet, that gap between the arising of the desire and the satisfaction of desire seems very slow, doesn't it? Because we want it to go quickly. Similarly, when we're really enjoying ourselves, having a wonderful time, then we can feel that time zips by. They say time flies when we're enjoying ourselves. So our subjective experience of time is affected by the presence or absence of desire, and by implication our relationship to the present moment. Actually, the more that our mind is interested in or obsessed with the past or the future, then the less real the present moment becomes. And conversely, the more interest and awareness we have in the present moment, then the less real become the past and the future. So in Buddhism, we're not so interested in establishing dogmas and trying to develop a doubt-free faith in dogmas as a way of creating inner security. But we're interested in looking at life, learning from life and learning from experience. I myself come from quite a secular family. I have one great aunt who's a churchgoer. Other than that, family quite relaxed about religious matters. And when I became a monk years and years ago, a lot of my family members got together, and apparently they were all saying, "Do you know, I never thought he was religious. Never struck me as being a particularly religious kind of person." And so we were wrong. And I said, "No, you're right, actually. You know, I don't consider this to be, you know, a religious matter in the way that you understand that to mean. You know, I don't see adopting beliefs about things as a way to peace. I see the way to peace through looking very clearly and very closely at the way things are and trying to eradicate the false assumptions and attachments that spring up and thrive through ignorance and lack of understanding." And so part of that is looking at the way our minds work, the way our minds move, those things that condition the mind, those things which are conditioned by the mind. And one of the qualities of the wise person or sage in Buddhism is the knowledge, the wisdom with regard, has wisdom with regard to time and place. And many people, I think, adopt a particular kind of style, personal style, and become identified with that. To speak in stereotypes, and perhaps the Western person tends to be overly ready to express inner thoughts and feelings, whereas the Eastern person, again, this is very stereotypical, is perhaps overly concerned with concealing those inner thoughts and feelings. The sage is somebody who doesn't have a fixed position or doesn't identify with any particular style or personality, but is someone who is sensitive to the needs of situations. In other words, has a sense for time and place. So there are certain times, certain places where we are obliged to be quiet and listen, learn. Other times when we may have to teach, other times to lead, times to follow, times to agree, times to disagree, times to be firm in one's principles, times to compromise, and so on. And there's no kind of book that you can read that will teach you in what situation you should adopt which particular stance or policy. But what you can learn to do is to train, educate your mind so that you have a feeling for what is the correct, the optimum response to a situation. This is the role of mindfulness, which we can develop through a number of exercises, as when we sit cross-legged and close our eyes and try to sustain attention on an object, but also something that we adopt as a way of being in the world. So when we understand the nature and the role of mindfulness, then there's not such a clear split between meditating and daily life. You know, there's a lot of discussion and of Dhamma talks on how to integrate Dhamma practice into daily life, but in fact that they're not, I don't see them as being separate in that way, because following the same principles, trying to do the same things. Simply that in the formal meditation sessions, then we cut down the outer entanglements and the stimulation from form, sounds, sense bases, and it gives us a much more untrammeled and focused appreciation of what's going on within our minds, rather than dealing with the interplay between the mind and the external world. So the formal meditation practice complements the practice during daily life. We're trying to find that awareness, presence of mind that enables us to act wisely. So one of the interesting definitions of mindfulness that was given by Ajahn Buddhadasa, one of the great modern Thai teachers, is that mindfulness means timely wisdom. That's not exact translation, but what he means is that when we are able to call upon our reserves, our knowledge, our understanding, our principles, and so on and so forth, in sufficient time to be able to deal creatively, constructively with situations, with challenges, with difficulties, then we can say we have mindfulness. So mindfulness is the condition for wisdom. So it's not that being in the present moment, being able to sustain attention in the present moment, is the goal itself, but it is the prerequisite for the fluent use of wisdom. And And if it is the authentic wisdom that's developed through the Eightfold Path, then arising together with it, co-emergent with the arising of wisdom in situations, is compassion. And they are like proofs of each other. So we can, the proof of wisdom is compassion, the proof of compassion is wisdom. That wisdom without compassion is merely sharpness, is smartness, it's a kind of amoral intelligence. But the kind of wisdom that we develop through Buddhist teaching is one in which we are aware of the whole situation. We are aware of, for instance, suffering, not as me suffering, my suffering, but suffering as a condition, a universal condition. We're aware of the pain that we create for ourselves, other people create for themselves and create for each other through lack of understanding. So we also see the causes and conditions for that suffering in the same way. So in the vision of someone who lacks that kind of clarity of mind and awareness, negative emotions arise when we see someone behaving in a very unkind, cruel fashion, and we say, you know, they're so cruel, they're so unkind, they're so selfish, and so on. And because we see those defilements and those negative qualities as being possessions of people, there are owners of those behaviors and conditions, then our own mind gets very stirred up. But with mindfulness, we see those negative conditions more as akin to viruses or illnesses. So just as if we were to become aware that someone has diabetes or has cancer or has some awful illness, our immediate response would be compassion. Through mindfulness, we begin to experience that same feeling when we see someone being very selfish or being very harsh and cruel and so on. We feel that they are afflicted, that they have become infected or afflicted by an illness. So our immediate response through that wise response to someone's behavior is compassion. So wisdom and compassion rising together based upon mindfulness. In the text that you may have studied, or you say that the mindful consciousness, the mindful mind, is one which is free of desire and grief for the world, or in Thai they often use the phrases yin di, yin rai, so liking, disliking, so on. So this is another leading feature, quality of mindfulness, of the kind which provides the basis for this wisdom and compassion. That is to say, it is a mind free of the habitual movement towards objects that arouse pleasant feelings and pushing away objects that arouse unpleasant feelings. Now, when we start to meditate and to look at our minds more closely, I think this is an insight that arises quite soon. We see how out of control our mind is, but also we see to what extent it is pulled around by impulses of liking and disliking. So every time we hear something, we see something, we hear something, a feeling arises, and there is an almost automatic reaction to that feeling. This is pre-verbal. It happens so quickly. And following on from that, there can be stronger desires accumulate, and then there is a giving of meaning and significance to experiences based upon the extent that they give us good or pleasant or unpleasant feelings. This is what in Buddhist terminology is called upadana, or attachment. You say, well, that's really good, and that's really... And what do you mean by really good? Well, it makes me feel good. I mean, that's bad because it makes me feel bad. I mean, we embellish this a lot and disguise it with all kinds of intellectual justifications, but, you know, the heart of it is often simply that we are reacting against what we don't like, and moving towards trying to absorb, to become one with, or to possess, to squeeze every last ounce of pleasure out of the things that we like. Now, so mindfulness is a kind of revolutionary approach to life, based upon a confidence and observation that it doesn't really work, that trying to push things away that you don't like just as a matter of course, firstly, is not always successful, so you're going to have to deal with those occasions when you can't do that, and the fact that you've tried to push them away makes the experience more unpleasant than it might do otherwise. Also, even on those occasions where you are successful, a certain amount of strain and tension is involved. And there is a fear and anxiety that perhaps sometime in the future you won't be able to do that again. So when your idea of happiness, comfort, security is based upon protecting yourself from certain kinds of experiences that you find threatening or unpleasant or painful, then there's no real peace there. But you feel vulnerable, you feel easily threatened, sometimes can reach the level of paranoia. Or similarly, if your idea of happiness is one based on the idea of being able to get certain things, whether it's material things, or be able to get a certain response, certain attitude from people, from things outside you. Again, you're not always going to be able to do it. There's a lot of strain, stress involved in the effort to get what you want. And then there's the insecurity and the pain of caring for and protecting what you've got once you've got it. And then the sadness and the pain that arises when you realize that you're inevitably going to be separated from that thing. So even although you may still not be completely separated from somebody or something, the very fact that it's not quite the way it used to be, that already is a form of separation. It's a form of alienation, which is painful. So we begin to see this in by looking at our minds and our experience more and more. As they say, it's not taking on some Buddhist teaching and dogma. Say, I'm Buddhist now, I believe this, that this is suffering and that's suffering. What we wanted to do is look at it. Is this suffering? Yes. So the Buddha wants us to ask questions and not take easy answers. And it's not at all considered disrespectful to ask questions and to be kind of stubborn and difficult and and to really to push things, because that's the way that you really break through the shell of wrong views and mistaken ideas about life that we've accumulated, perhaps as an inheritance from past lives, but more particularly from present life, from our upbringing, from family, from culture, and so on and so forth. So we're training ourselves to be with ourselves, and it helps a great deal, of course, if you're willing to at least to take on trust the idea that underneath all the outer shells and the personality and all the kind of stuff, deep down inside, you're really worth getting to know and you're really good company. If you can take that on as at least as a working hypothesis, it helps a lot. You know, if you start off, you say, I'm just really this kind of nasty person, or I'm a really boring person, and there's nothing in my life which is really kind of interesting or special, or, you know, that kind of cynical, dark kind of attitude to oneself that many people carry around, then it's going to be a lot more difficult. So I would point out something that I've noticed, that we tend to, I think, give much more weight to negative perceptions than we do to positive perceptions. That when people are negative, that the conceit that arises in the negative, cynical mind is, I'm being realistic, I'm facing up to the hard truths of life that other people are just shutting their eyes to. And so anybody who looks at things in a more positive way is just trying to kid themselves, and it's not really brave enough to look at the dark truths of life. But that's just an attitude and a conceit as well. And sometimes we may do something very noble, kind, completely selfless, with no desire for any personal reward of any kind. And then maybe just for one moment, it would just be like a fleeting thought that when such and such a person finds out, then they're really going to admire me, or they're going to praise me, or and often the mind will just jump onto that single stray thought and make a big deal out of it. And you say, yeah, like that's who I really am, isn't it? This is what it's really all about, isn't it? And this is just basically a deluded habit of the mind, that through mindfulness you can recognize and say, well, why should that thought be any more real, any more me than all the very noble and beautiful thoughts that preceded it and succeeded it. So seeing thoughts as thoughts, and seeing that they have a similar value, that we don't prioritize thoughts according to whether they fit in with our ideas of who we are. We're willing just to see a thought as a thought, and a negative thought as a negative thought, and a positive thought as a positive thought, and being able to see things that is just that, it's nothing more. Then the mind becomes very cool in that way, and you're not having to sort of defend certain positions, or to feel that your integrity and your personality and who you are is dependent on particular mental states and particular attitudes. So there's a certain amount of courage, bravery involved here, but it's based upon the willingness to look and to learn and a kind of interest and think, oh yeah, that's interesting. I never saw that before. And some of the things that you see are totally irrational and embarrassing, and that's all right. I mean, it's part of it. I'll tell you something that happened to me recently. I realized that sometime my basic conceit that I have about myself, which is completely irrational, is that I'm invisible. Okay, and a number of times in my life that I've been surprised when people have actually seen me. This is partly because as a child I had asthma for many, many years, and so I was always sort of separate, often off school by myself, and I was put up a year at school, so I was always studying with children who were older than me, so that sort of emphasized a sense of difference and separateness. And when I was 17, I left school and went overland to India, and traveling nearly all the time by myself, and just like to sit back into sort of dark, dusty corners of tea shops and sort of watch people go by. And so sort of identifying more and more with this idea of myself as an observer and as someone who is basically unseen. And this kind of conceit, I realize, has never completely disappeared, even years as an abbot of a large monastery and being very much in the public eye. And so last November, my mother and my sister-in-law, my brother's wife, were visiting, and we were up in Ubon. We were waiting for a car, and my sister-in-law was looking down at the ground, and she said, "You know, your toes are just like your brother's." And my immediate reaction was, how does she know that? Even though I was standing with sandals on, you know, my feet were completely exposed. And so this is not a particularly profound Dhamma point, other than to show you that it's possible to have these kind of weird, irrational, strange kind of thoughts in the mind, which, when you don't have a fixed idea of who you are or who you want to be, you can accept. And you know, oh yeah, that's kind of interesting. And actually, from there, I was able to see certain other kind of incidents in my life and misunderstandings with people I've had and so on that came out from just assuming that people couldn't see me or that I was invisible. So this is just one example of kind of the study, the things that you get to see and understand by just being willing to open up. And one of the kind of helpful images that you can have is of your mind like sky or like the ocean, so that whatever the thoughts and the emotions that arise, these are things that are appearing within the sky, for instance. So like clouds and birds and planes and insects and so on. But there's nothing that's larger than the sky that can threaten the sky. But if you feel that you're being carried away by thoughts and by emotions, it means that you're grasping on to one small life form, one small phenomena that's just passing through the sky. So it's not that I'm laying this down as kind of a metaphysical principle, some sort of mystic idea. You know, the mind is like the sky. But like with most or almost all of Buddhist teachings, that they are there as tools to be used. You can take on certain kind of images, similes, metaphors, particular ways of looking in order to see things more clearly, in order to prevent the mind from falling into a rut or getting confused or deluded by things. So one of the, recap somewhat, through the development of mindfulness, we're developing a contentment, clarity, and simple down-to-earth pleasure in being awake. And remember, the word Buddha means the awakened one. And so we're seeking to develop this quality of wakefulness, the awakened mind, moment by moment. And to the extent that we can do that, then this sense of lack and the idea that we can become more fulfilled, more real by absorbing experiences from outside of ourselves, by filling the mind with thoughts and memories and imagination, starts to fall away. And you see just a very simple breathing in, breathing out in the present moment can provide a source of very deep contentment and happiness that we are unable to experience through grasping at passing phenomena outside of coming from outside of ourselves. So our attitude to time changes. And if we develop the meditation to the level where the mind puts down all the thinking, temporarily at least, we can go into a completely timeless realm. Again, it's subjectively timeless. And it may last for a few minutes or may last for some hours. But it is a marvelous experience to have, and it opens up the possibility of a whole new dimension to life. We see that it's possible to be completely wide awake with a deep sense of rightness and fulfillment and peace, happiness, which is completely separate from any kind of mental activity, any kind of physical activity. Now, while one is experiencing that state, if one should be so fortunate, there's no real analysis going on. That's not the time for those mental functions. But withdrawing, emerging from such a state, and being able to review it and consider it in terms of its implications for who you think you are, what you think life is about. This is where some real deep insights can come about. And one insight or one thing that many meditators will refer to is very deeply enhanced confidence in rebirth, for instance, because if you've experienced that state of intense well-being, completely independent of all physical mental processes, which you normally take to be your life and who you are, then the teaching of rebirth becomes a lot more rational and easy to comprehend. It is, of course, not a proof of it, but it is an experience which, as I say, very much increases one's willingness to accept that teaching as being authentic. So the teaching of rebirth is, and I've mentioned this before in previous talks, not a dogma you must believe in if you're a Buddhist, but it is very helpful if you have a confidence in it, because it has implications for so many other areas of your life. For instance, how you prioritize your use of time. You know, what's worth doing? Okay, if you believe you've got so many years left, and then that's it, that's the end of things. Your mind is a kind of a epiphenomena of all the chemicals and circuits in your brain, and when your brain dies, you die. And so you've got this much time left, and then it's the end forever. And if you believe that there is rebirth, then the rebirth that you'll take will be significantly conditioned by how you live this particular life, then that will surely affect what you put your energy into, what you put your effort into in this life. The Buddha said that as long as one has not yet reached the level of stream entry, then one's still unsafe, basically, and could easily create the karma to be reborn in a lower realm. So if we're willing to take on that as a hypothesis, then what does that tell us about how we should spend our time? So the very last teaching of the Buddha before he left the world, now we say entered Parinibbana, was that all things are subject to change, and therefore you should be heedful. And this word, heedful, or appamada, is a very important word in the Buddhist teachings. And the word heedful is usually defined as being more or less equivalent to maintaining mindfulness. But it's particularly used in relationship to time, using time, what you're doing with your time. One of the 10 daily reflections of the Buddhist monk is, days and nights are relentlessly passing. What are you doing right now? And so how are you spending your time? And so because life is slipping away so quickly, because time is limited, time is a human being, and this lifetime in which we have the capacity, the energy to develop in Dhamma, is rapidly diminishing, then Buddha says we should give great deal of attention to how we spend our time and to seeing the value of the time that we have together, seeing that we don't really have the time to indulge in petty jealousies and fights and arguments about next to nothing, because time is just too short. So considering time as being something that's passing away rapidly, but one in which makes asking us questions about how we use that time, based within a worldview of rebirth, and one in which our present actions of body, speech and mind are creating the future that we will experience. These are the kinds of reflections that we bring up. So I know that some people are sometimes somewhat critical of Buddhists who make merit in order to be reborn in heaven realms and so on, and certainly the Buddha never praised such action. But at the same time, it's not completely foolish if heaven realms exist. I mean, if there's nothing after this, the end of this life, then it would be foolish preparing for something that is just a dream. But if rebirth in heaven realms can be conditioned through how we behave in this world, then it's not a foolish way of living one's life particularly. But the Buddha says that there's something superior to that, but he didn't say that was a completely fruitless activity. So it's more a matter of seeing that even if you're reborn in a heaven realm, it doesn't last. And even though that in clock time it may be considered to last eons, millions and millions of years. In subjective time it might be just over in a flash, and then you're back where you started, or even worse. So Buddha said that the only real freedom, the only real peace, comes through understanding that we create moment by moment a sense of self through attachment to different aspects of body and mind. So there's not this thing called an ego that you have to get rid of. What is occurring is moment by moment there is identification with the body, with feelings, with memories, with imagination, thoughts, and so on and so forth. And this stream of attachments, which is constantly changing and fluctuating, this is what's sometimes given the name of the ego. But it's not a thing, and it's not a thing that you can get rid of. But it's an action. It's a moment by moment grasping onto things through not understanding the way they truly exist. So developing mindfulness and being able to look clearly and say, well, what is really going on here? What is this body? What is this mind? What is thought? What is imagination? What is attachment? What is desire? So not sort of taking all these things on and saying, yeah, I've got to, this is the Buddhist take on life. They're saying, the Buddha's given all these tools for us to use to look at what's going on. These contingent labels to help us to see beyond the labels. And to the extent that we reach the stage, the Buddha says, we're independent of all teachers and all external factors in the Buddha's dispensation. So the teacher is taken as to be someone like a doctor who says, look, this is the medicine that the Buddha's made up for us. Take this so many times a day, you know, and when you feel better, then you've taken the whole course, then you can stop. So you know, the ethical wise doctor doesn't want to create a dependence on the doctor himself or on the medicine, but he wants to encourage people to take the medicine and get better. So we have limited time together, and I think that's probably sufficient for the talk this afternoon. So if you'd like to just have 5 minutes, stretch your legs, and then we'll have a meditation period together.